Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What must it be like to watch turmoil in your home country from thousands of miles away? A local professor from Nigeria is doing just that as the world wonders about the fate of those kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls. We'll be talking about all of that in just a couple of moments. But first, reporter Kevin Colleen of KMOX Radio has written yet another book about the antics of a Webster Groves youngster growing up 45 years ago. First came his book, Never Hug a Nun, a little over a year ago. His latest is Try to Kiss a Girl. Once again, the story revolves around young Patrick Cantwell, but this time he's on vacation with his family at a Michigan lake resort and, thanks to a vacation buddy, finds himself in phase one of learning the facts of life. The game is on, thanks to a $5 bet as to which of the two 11-year-olds can kiss a girl for the first time during their one-week vacation. Kevin Colleen joins me in studio.
Don, that's a better summary than the book.
Well, we can stop talking about the
phase
book now.
Phase one.
Well, do we want to get to the home run phase of the book? And I think a lot of people of a certain age will recognize what we mean when we talk about hitting a home run as a youngster.
Yeah, you know, I thought that this was traipsing on delicate issues, but one of the lady readers said that everyone remembers that one summer where you find out the facts of life and you try to sort of put your toe in the water, and or you have a crush on somebody. And in this case, this kid who is just in awe that he has missed this hidden secret, this underlying agenda of all adults that's been spanning the centuries, he decides, you know, he's got to do something about it. So they make a $5 bet to see who can kiss a girl before the week is over.
You know, you talk about learning the facts of life as a youngster. The only problem with that, as I see it, is you're generally learning the facts of life from another 11 or 12-year-old.
Yeah, well, in my case, and the book is based on this, it was a great step up from the misinformation that I was operating under. I thought it had some, and I was 11 as the kid in the book, I thought it had something to do with something the doctor did. Because every time my mom would come back from the doctor, he had done something to her where she would say, my parents were kind of like the Chrysler Corporation. They were announcing a new model every year. But, you know, when it was explained, you know, just the rudimentaries of first base and so on, that was like, wow, even Lincoln must have been in on this, you know, hiding it from the nation.
Everybody, I guess, had to be in on it one way or another. So we've established the fact once again, as in Never Hug a Nun, that young Patrick Cantwell is actually Kevin Colleen.
Well, a little bit. It's, you know, it's like, you know, is James Bond Ian Fleming, you know. It's a fictionalized version of some things that I went through. But I think a lot of people remember the idea of the old fashioned vacations and the things that are kind of universal that are talked about.
Yeah, one of the things you point out, you say it's a tribute to the lost era of station wagon vacations and rental colleges with aunts.
Yes, and they were slope floors, usually musty cottages, but to get to these Michigan or Wisconsin places, which are Lake of the Ozarks, like a lot of St. Louisans remember, you would pack the luggage on top, and this was before the pre-plastic molded luggage carriers. I mean, these were, you know, World War II veterans with Navy knots tying these big luggages down. And in the station wagon, it was the dawn of the age of air conditioning. And a lot of fathers like mine thought air conditioning was a risky invention, you know, especially on a very hot day, like when it's 95 degrees on the flats of Illinois. That's the time we should roll down all the windows, you know, even the way back seat. And so we were like the potato head family, just driving across the cornfields, baking in this station wagon. And you'd see signs for like Stuckey's Malts, and, you know, the big trucks would roar by. But there was no GPS, no cell phones, no in-car video cameras. You're kind of left to 20 questions in your own wits.
And other things, some of which we will not mention. We don't want to ruin the plot of the first couple of pages.
Oh, I don't mind. You're talking about the Wonder Bread bag incident?
Wonder Bread bag incident.
Well, when we were sitting in the far back seat, which was called the way back seat, you would see the landscape pulling away like the tail gunner in a B-24. Mm-hmm. And you were cut off from immediate adult supervision because the kids in the middle seat, you know, they mom and dad knew what they were up to. But in this instance, my brother and I were 11, and we had stolen some orange sodas that we shouldn't have. And so we were due for an earlier bathroom break than the rest of the gang. And we just saw, you know, this empty Wonder Bread bag flapping in the breeze. And we said, what about this? And it seemed like a great idea. until it hit the hot, steaming hot pavement of Interstate 57, and there was this atomized mist that just expanded like a galaxy on public television. And it got really scary when in the distance we saw some motorcycles approaching, because we thought, you know, we drop it here and that's where it stays, but it was people were moving into it. And that's where prayer really came in.
And it's part of the ongoing story, I must say. The bikers are, at least. You know, young Patrick seemed to have a little bit of a problem with stealing things. In the first book, of course, it was at the Ben Franklin where he was had larceny on his mind, and he talked about the orange sodas here.
Yeah, well, you know, theft really ran in the Killeen family from generations back. But I like the idea that this character, he's always in trouble, and the first book was kind of a comedy on the perils of self-redemption, that he can never really be good. He always screws up. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, where he drops the Wonder Bread bag out the window, he prays, if I can get away with this, I'll be good the whole vacation. But, you know, that's not going to happen.
Well, prayer is an important part of young Patrick's life, but even more so to his mother.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they're very, very much into the Catholic faith.
Yes, there is always, you know, banging of pots and pans on the first day of such vacations because it was Sunday. And instead of being able to just sit there and watch the beach or go swimming, you had to go to the local Catholic Mass. And there were always strange priests there with brogues that were unfamiliar. And the people, you know, in a different town, they look like the worshipers in Beneath the Planet of the Apes who worship the bomb. You know, they always like, there's different, there's an otherness about them. But, you know, Mom was always there where we have to remember, you know, to be good on vacation and do the right thing. But, you know, it wasn't always easy.
The stabilizing force. What got you started in all of this, Kevin? There seems to be kind of a nostalgia thing going on with you. You were telling me off the air that you're living in the house that you grew up in, which is unusual. Not many people get a chance to do that.
Yeah, it's very, as I was saying, it's very neurotic because, you know, you're at my weight now and age, the floorboards beneath my feet are creaking the same way they did under my father's footprints. Mm-hmm. And one night I was so tired that I went to bed and I began to go to the left into my boyhood bedroom. I thought, no, wait, I'm over here now. And so there is a nostalgia. I said to myself, I wouldn't want to see another family with their Christmas tree in our window. And so I don't know how long I can keep up with Webster Groves property taxes and squirrels. But for now, you know, we're fighting the good fight.
Well, you know, as you know, we gave it up about 3 years ago. No more cutting the lawn, no more raking the leaves. And that's not bad. With regard to the nostalgia, one of the things I enjoyed about the book was little things, like talking about going into a gas station and driving over that pink hose. And I can still hear in my mind's ear,
ding, ding,
ding, ding, and someone coming out and actually putting gas in your car. Some of the products you mentioned, Rice-A-Roni, and some of the things that aren't so much a part of our lives anymore. You really found that era very nicely.
Well, a lot of those products are still in our basement, but yeah, I do have a memory for you know, the places of like gas stations and drug stores, because it seems like so much has changed. You don't go into a drugstore anymore in Michigan and see a copper tone display with the dog pulling the little girl's pants down, and the ad encouraging you to get as tan as you can. Now it's all sunblock, and just lots of little things like that. Burger Chef. We used to stop at a restaurant called Burger Chef. I remember the kids on these long trips would chant, Burger Chef, Burger Chef. And now it doesn't exist. It was bought out by Burger King or Hardee's.
I guess so. There used to be one at Hampton and Oakland. And now that's a Burger King, I guess. But they were all over the place, obviously. Burger Chef was very big, very big. What else do I remember about that 45 years ago summer? And one of the things that you point out in the book and keep referring to it are the history of that time. This is all set during the time of the Apollo flight to the moon.
Yeah, I set the book during the week in July of 1969, where the whole nation is straining toward the monumental goal of going to the moon. It's sort of a backdrop to how it's just as monumental for these boys to be trying to kiss a girl. But also in that time, and this was true of Grand Haven in the 60s, even though it was a family town with moms and strollers, there was an edginess where you would see bikers roaring in, and Easy Rider was playing at the Grand Theater. And there was always this suggestion that there's another world different from your parents where, you know, the bikers are out with their girls holding them tight and so they wouldn't fall off and hit the highway and that they have a better life. You know, we used to wish we could grow up to be bikers someday.
Yeah, particularly with the girls in the back seat of the motorcycle. It was very provocative to our young protagonist in this book.
Yeah, he tangles with some bikers in the book, and he also has run-ins with the biker women who, you know, he notes they have faces like catcher's mitts, and they're just they've been sun-baked, and they're kind of a hard-boiled group.
Let's talk about the two young ladies that are the targets of our young Rex and Patrick, the two boys who are, have this bet to kiss a girl before the end of the vacation. What about the two girls they target?
Well, they are Ginny and Tammy, who are Southern Belles. They're from Atlanta, and they're staying up, if you've been in Grand Haven, at the Cardinal Lodge. And Ginny is a friend of Tammy, and Tammy's father, Mr. Jawthorne, is very protective. He runs a trucking company. He's a direct descendant of Southerners who lost his fortune to Sherman's raiders. And he's only in the North because it's cool, but he's very suspicious of all these Northern boys, these Yankee boys running around. And he keeps a tight rein on his daughter and her friend. And they, you know, they remind me of some girls that we would go to Florida and would meet who you would hear the music of the speech of these Southern girls, and it was so unlike the flat, nasal tone, you know, monotone sound of St. Louis girls. And it was distracting sometimes. It was like a piano solo where you'd think, now, what did she just say? I was listening to the melody and not the words.
One of the interesting things about these two girls, same age as the boys, obviously, 11, 12 in that area, is as young ladies, they were very savvy. I mean, they knew they had a couple of guys on the hook here. They didn't know exactly what the boys were up to, but they knew how to handle them.
Yeah, I found that was true with girls, even at 11. They know how to get a quarter out of you for a pinball game or take you into town and pay for my Pronto pup. And all the while, the boys are scheming, you know, how can we get them to want to kiss us and get them to the movie theater? And there was always drawing of maps of, you know, a possible sand dune makeout area. But I guess if the book is a comedy, it's because they seem to get frustrated and they have so many obstacles. As did ever happen to you, where you had it mapped out in your mind how the date was going to go?
I can't tell you in how many different ways this story reminds me of my time. I used to go to the Jersey Shore, and a lot of the same kind of things you're writing about in this book happened on the Jersey Shore with young people such as myself. For me, it hit very close to home.
Yeah. Did you have any disastrous attempts at the first kiss?
Every attempt I ever made since has been a disaster. Kevin Killeen is our guest. We have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back in just a moment. Continue our conversation. We're talking about his brand-new book, Try to Kiss a Girl. Kevin Killeen, our guest, back in just a moment. If you'd like to talk to Kevin, feel free to do so by giving us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, we'll take one at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd rather send a tweet, do so at STL On Air. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. And we'll continue our conversation with Kevin Killeen about his new book titled Try to Kiss a Girl. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Archdiocese of St. Louis settled the civil case against it that was supposed to start today. In a press conference this morning, the church announced it had settled for an undisclosed amount with the plaintiff, known as Jane Doe, 92. Doe had accused former priest Joseph Ross of abusing her in the late 1990s and early 2000s. She's also accused the church of putting her and other children at risk by moving Ross from parish to parish, even after he had pleaded guilty to inappropriate conduct with children. And Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander is touting a first-in-the-nation way of making it easier for military personnel to cast absentee ballots via a web-based app. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on 90.7 KWMU and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our guest, Kevin Killeen. One of the things I also noticed about the book, Kevin, that struck me as a little bit odd was the fact that these two boys running around trying to kiss these two girls, never really spent any time swimming. And here was this wonderful lake right in front of them.
Well, I guess I wanted to keep it to the action, but there were times when you would jump off the pier, sometimes in a storm or to try to, on what they called a red flag day, which were the very dangerous days when the waves were high and the undertow was threatening to pull you out. So there's always just a little bit of a hint of death is on the horizon when you're up in Michigan having fun as a kid.
Was this on Lake Michigan? It's never really clear in my mind if that's the lake.
Grand Haven is a coastal town about 8 hours from St. Louis. It's a little bit above Saugatuck and Douglas. Up in that way.
It's a long way to drive for just a couple of days at the beach.
Well, we would go up there for a week or two. And in the book, I like the idea that a week on a trip that you try to make into a paradise is just kind of like a mirrors the fact that a seven-decade life goes so fast. And you start out the vacation, you think, this is going to be great. It's going to last forever. You're going to do a lot of things. But all of a sudden, it's Wednesday and you're 40.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I have here in my notes something I wanted to talk about. And I wrote to myself, it seems like the mortality issue seems to work its way into the book, because during the sermon at church, the priest said you only have 1 week, which is in translated metaphor for seven decades, and that's the average lifespan at that particular time. Is that something you think about? Is mortality creeping into your thought process?
I think it is, because I'm in the Thursday of my life, so I'm in my 50s, and I don't know. My father died a few years ago, and my mother's getting old, and maybe I'm just to that point where I see after 20 years in the business that I'm in, the time goes so fast, and the book as one part, which I got from a friend, Clank Wagner, he's a great student of the brevity of life. He takes out a tape measure, as one character does in the book, to pull out 74 inches and say, okay, here's your lifespan. And you go to the inch that represents your age, and you think, my gosh, look at all the inches I've already used up.
That's kind of scary. I mean, I don't think anyone who is older than 11 years old is going to get to that part of the book and not start thinking about life and the brevity thereof.
Well, he would use that to encourage his friends to retire and spend some time on themselves. You know, don't just keep going to work.
You say your father passed away, and there is a period in the book where young Patrick is very, very concerned about his father's health. Was as you were writing this, was your father still alive? Was that on your mind?
No, he had passed away, but I think my father, and this is in the book, where the kids always get lectures on don't smoke because it could kill you. Yeah. And at one point in the book, one of the characters' father has died, and then Patrick, the main character, thinks his dad has cancer. And it just sort of makes him see his dad in a new way, where, you know, what if your dad isn't going to be there forever? And it's something that a few times as a kid I would think about, because you hear about the awful truth where some of your friends' dads die, and you think, well, how could that even happen before I'm grown up?
Yeah. And it's a sad time and a hard time for any youngster who have to go through that, obviously.
And I don't mean to think, you know, make it sound like the book is morbid. It's mostly a comedy. Oh. But since we are dealing with the facts of life and how to get to first base, right. I threw in a little bit of the facts of death and how when you find out about that on a vacation, it kind of balances it out.
One of the things that I always have to say with authors and talking about novels is it's sometimes fairly hard to talk about specifics because you don't want to give everything away. I mean, I think what we've done here is establish that these two boys have a mission, and the book is a very charming and light. And
did you laugh at all? Did you have to, like, get up and go to the bathroom?
No, I didn't.
Well, that's my highest accolade I'm looking for.
To get up and have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, this book was so funny I had to go to the bathroom. Don Marsh, we can put that on the back.
Hey, I noticed you've got some fairly prestigious blurbs on the back here. Our friend Ridley Pearson is fond of the book. And George Norrie, there's a blast from the past. He's made his way back to St. Louis, at least on the back cover of your book.
I asked George Norrie, as you know, he's the Flying Saucer Bigfoot UFO guy, to review it, because one of the characters in the book is obsessed with the Mothman, that mysterious character from well, I don't want to ruin the story, but so I thought George would love, you know, this book, and he was kind enough to say that it was fun. That was, and he's also from Michigan, from Detroit.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Detroit. I had almost forgotten about that. I've known George for more years than I'd like to admit, and he never misses an opportunity to get his name in print or get himself out there before the public one way or another. What about the rest of your family? What is their reaction to both of these books?
Well, my aunt, who is a nun, never did get back with me on Never Hug a Nun because in the story, the nun quits the nunnery and gets married. And I don't know if she was offended that I was suggesting that would have been a happier life path. But the rest of my siblings, they like pointing out, oh, that was me in there and that was her. And, I haven't had any backlash because I think for the most part it's a kind portrayal of a quirky family.
Yeah, mostly about young Patrick, needless to say. Is there a favorite part of the book in terms of your writing it that you found in the writing that it was more pleasurable than other parts or somehow struck a chord with you that maybe you didn't expect?
Well, they always say if you have a favorite part of the book, that's probably the worst part, all your darling sentences. But I just like the little things. It was I wrote this over the winter when we had such a bad winter, and I felt like I spent the summer in Grand Haven over the winter. And writing about the sound of the waves or the smell of the drugstore that used to be there, or that you would walk in, you could smell the malt makers and the grilled cheese sandwiches, and just the little places around town, the setting, describing the setting was fun for me. And it's always fun to write when there's a lot of action. I think there's a lot of chasing around and excitement in this book and a lot of get-to-first-base drama from an 11-year-old's perspective.
And we can let folks figure out if they haven't already the getting to first base and the home run aspect of this story is very prominent. What's next for Kevin Kleen? Do we continue with Patrick Cantwell?
Well, I think I should just rest for a while and see if the public wants me to stop all this nonsense or if there's enough interest that maybe – I do have an idea for a book that where a girl would be the main character, about an eighth-grade girl. And it was based on a true story of a girl in our parish who, when we would get in trouble, the principal would always turn the phone around and say, "Don, you've been in trouble. Uh-huh. Call your mom and tell her you're going home." But this girl called Time and Temperature. And then just faked a conversation, spent the rest of the day out on the golf course. So I thought, that's a character there. Somebody could pull that off.
On such things does a whole novel turn, I suppose. Huh? Writing about a girl, that might be a little bit difficult for a fellow who grew up as Patrick Cantwell. Here.
Yeah, I only have one sister. We're from a family of seven boys and one girl. And I think she learned more about us than we learned about her. I wish I'd paid better attention. We used to put firecrackers in the grip of her Barbie dolls and just knock on the window and say, "Look at this."
And in the book, the little girl has a doll, the Betsy Wetsy doll, and ultimately the next child born is named
Betsy Wetsy or Betsy. That was a true doll that my father was very afraid of. That was a threat to the upholstery in the car. It was a doll that actually wet its pants. Yeah. And it meant a lot to my sister, but it was a real upholstery threat, Betsy Wetsy, because you could put Coca-Cola or root beer in it and it would all come out.
As boys were wont to do, needless to say. Well, Kevin, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and especially a pleasure reading about this young man who tries to kiss a girl.
Thank you.
That's another success for you. The first Never Hug a Nun did quite well, did it not?
It was a moderate success locally. A lot of people read it.
Yeah. Well, that's what you want, is a lot of people to read it, and I hope the same happens here. Is this a catharsis for you, writing these books after a hard day at the running around town chasing politicians and good guys and bad guys?
Yeah, it is, because I feel like everything that I do on the news lasts a day and a half, and maybe this will last 2 days and a half.
Yeah, the news cycle isn't very long. We're going to be talking about that with our next guest, by the way. We're going to be talking about the Nigerian schoolgirls who were abducted in April. Mm. And the world was up in arms and outraged by all of this. And then suddenly they seemed to forget about these kids who were still out there somewhere. Kevin Kleen, thank you so much.
Don, thanks for having me on.
Let me point out that you're going to be at Left Bank Books in the Central West End Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock for a release party for the book. stop by and meet him and pick up a copy of Try to Kiss a Girl and your other places, too. Do you have a list of where?
Maplewood on the Thursday, the 10th, at the Maplewood Bookhouse on Manchester across from Shop and Save at 7 o'clock. And then finally Saturday at the Webster Groves Bookshop at the corner of Gore and Lockwood. You know that shop.
I know the shop.
From 11 to 3.
All right. We'll have that information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Good luck with it, Kevin.
Don,
great to see you again.
Much.
Coming up, a local professor watching events in his homeland, Nigeria, wondering, as we all do, about those kidnapped schoolgirls. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.